Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently.
Hello, Max. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, absolutely. It's an absolute pleasure and honor to have you. You're one of the biggest authors and contributors to the Bitcoin system. And of course, what you did was this one, The Bitcoin Standard, the best book, hands down, second to none, that we have in Bitcoin right now. I used to say that about Andreas Antonopoulos' books. He has not a chance against you, especially regarding economics. So I think you really made it.
What can I say? I mean, thank you. Andreas's books are great. I learned a lot from Andreas. So I don't want to badmouth him.
No, he is amazing. There's no doubt. But you hit the economics of Bitcoin. You just explained this perfectly. And we're going to start off just reading some of the quotes, because honestly, they are perfect. So those are quotes from the book, The Bitcoin Standard, that you can buy now. Bitcoin can be best understood as distributed software that allows for transfer of value using a currency protected from unexpected inflation without relying on trusted third party. For something to assume a monetary role, it has to be costly to produce. Otherwise, the temptation to make money on the cheap will destroy the wealth of the savers and destroy the incentive anyone has to save this medium. Human civilization flourishes in times and places where sound money was widely adopted, while unsound money all too frequently coincided with civilizational decline and social collapse. Those are just a few quotes that we have from this amazing book. So Saifedean, of course, this is a masterpiece, and it is evident that you have not written this within a week or two, and that you have studied Austrian economics and Bitcoin for quite some time. So actually, when did you get into Austrian economics and why?
I got into Austrian economics about 10 years ago, I think. Well, 11. So 2007, really. I was doing my PhD at Columbia University, I was writing my PhD on a topic that might seem strange for people who see me in Bitcoin now, but it was about alternative energy, in particular about biofuels. And so while the topic itself was, it doesn't strike you as something that has to do with the Austrian economics, I had an engineering background, and I was studying, my program was grounded in economics. So what I was trying to do with my PhD was to effectively centrally plan or centrally calculate how to make an energy system that produces desirable environmental and energy outcomes. And so I started looking at, whether biofuels are good or bad, whether they should be adopted widely or not. And that led me to start, making very complicated mathematical calculations and looking at some extremely complex studies of these questions. But the more methodical I tried to be, the more accurate and precise that I tried to be with these calculations, the more I realized it's a very complicated question. It's a complex question. And so that then led me down the path of reading Karl Popper. I also read I read Nassim Taleb, which was very influential at that point in 2007. His book, The Black Swan, first came out. So around that period, I was reading Nassim Taleb and Karl Popper and thinking about, falsification, what is scientific, how to do math, how to calculate complex phenomena. And then that led me down the path of reading Hayek. And then that led me to Mises.org. And then I've spent the last 10 years basically reading stuff off of Mises.org. And it's been about 10, 11 years of learning Austrian economics. So the book was not written in 10, 11 years, but it took about 10 years of learning Austrian economics to be able to write this book as it came out.
Yes, I can only imagine. And the learning curve is quite steep. But when you have studied Austrian economics for 10 years, I'm sure that writing the book itself was quite a simple task. Not a simple task, obviously, but because you had this vast amount of knowledge, you knew what was going to happen. And, we stand on the shoulders of giants such as Murray Rothbard, and he has written extensively about gold and the gold standard. And the work has been done. And you have adapted it now. You have evolutionized it to its next stage, which is talking about Bitcoin, of course. So unless, because you're studying Austrian economics for 10 years now, unless you're Satoshi Nakamoto and have founded Bitcoin before you got into Austrian economics, or you have first studied Austrian economics and then went to Bitcoin, right? That is the correct way, I would say. And so how did you find Bitcoin? And did you immediately realize its importance based on your Austrian economic knowledge?
I don't even remember when I first heard about Bitcoin. It's sad. Everybody always asks me this question, and I wish I had a fun story to tell, but I really just don't. It happened either in 2009 or in 2010. I don't know where I heard about it initially, but it was somewhere on the internet, somewhere basically where Austrian economists discuss gold and money and these issues. So it's 2009, 2010, I first heard of it. And initially, it was just a weird little experiment that I didn't pay much attention to, because at that time there wasn't much chance to pay much attention to it, particularly if you weren't a programmer like I am. I'm not a programmer. So, there wasn't much literature to read. There was no simple explanations. It was just a code and software that some people ran. And I heard about it. I found it a little interesting, but I obviously thought, this can't work. We thousands of years, if you read the Austrian economists, we've had thousands of years of people coming up with things that they think are going to be better than gold or the new gold or something like that. And it's not really worked out well for anybody who's made that attempt. You know, we've had hundreds and thousands of years of con artists, from old alchemists to John Maynard Keynes, trying to tell you that they've found the scam that's better than gold, and it's always turned out to not work. And so, you know, that's really where I was approaching Bitcoin from, and that's why I sort of understand the skepticism that most Austrians, I'm not sure if I would say most, but the skepticism that Austrians can have towards it, because it's not the first time that somebody thinks that they've found a way to make gold better. And so, you know, I used to be skeptical of it. It was only really until 2013 that I started to take it seriously, because, you know, it refused to go away, it refused to die. And then the more it refused to die, the more I spent time reading about it, learning about it, and understanding it. And then, you know, all of the objections that I had about why it couldn't work were being disproven one by one. So one particularly important moment for me was when the Silk Road website was closed down. Because until then, you know, I had imagined that this was how Bitcoin dies. I'd imagined there will be some website that uses Bitcoin, somebody, and I didn't even think that it would have to be somebody who uses drugs. It could be just, you know, Bitcoin is going to be announced to be related to drugs or terrorism or something bad. And then that would be used as an excuse to put somebody in jail for using Bitcoin, and then that would just destroy the market demand for Bitcoin, and then it would go back to just being this weird network online that nobody uses or cares about. And, you know, when the Silk Road bust happened, this looked like it was going to happen, so the price dropped for about 20-30% or so. But then 2-3 days later, the price rebounded, and more interestingly, the volume of transactions didn't really drop. And the network continued. So the notion that this was just money being used on the dark market for drugs was falsified, and the fact that, you know, somebody was going to go to jail because they used Bitcoin did not destroy Bitcoin. And I mean, obviously, they didn't go to jail specifically for Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is why they were busted, it seems, most likely. So when that happened, I started revising and reconsidering my perspective on it. And that's when I really started to take it more seriously, started to try and read and learn more and more about it.
Absolutely. It is always surprising how resistant and how anti-fragile Bitcoin is. So we have Miko from Maximal Liberty joining us live. Miko, I'm sure you have a bunch of questions, but first, please introduce yourself.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Hi, Max. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, my name is Nico. I'm the chairman of Finnish Cryptocurrency Association. And Saifedean, it's a pleasure to be on the stream with you. It's a great honor. I loved your book. And yeah, I'll be happy to ask some questions as well here.
Wonderful. Pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. So yeah, I really liked what you said. I had a similar experience with Bitcoin and Silk Road as well. I thought that it's going to, once Silk Road goes down, Bitcoin's going to go down. And curiously enough, it didn't. And then I myself got back into it like around 2016 when I started looking up and I realized that it's not going to go away. And that was like kind of like the revelation point for me. I too got into Bitcoin at first in 2010. I mined it on the laptop for a while. And it was like you said, play money, kind of like this nerdy experiment for me. I didn't really take it seriously. And pretty interesting to hear that you had a similar...
Can I just tell you a little story here? I'm not sure if it was 2010 or 2011. I tried to download the software and mine on my laptop, but my laptop was not up for the task, and it just kept on crashing every time I started it. It might have been the point at which, you know, mining on your own laptop stopped being economical, so I just was never able to do it. If I'd succeeded in doing it for maybe 15 minutes, it might have changed my life, but, you know, I think it's for the better. I used to have these regrets about, you know, all the times that I could have bought at the cheaper price, but I don't anymore because I just think if I had acquired Bitcoin in any way earlier, I would have most likely lost it or had it hacked or had it stolen or even sold at a very low price because, you know, you only really buy when you're really ready, and it's pointless to try and wish that you were ready earlier. I had to really learn it properly, so I've gotten over that disappointment. But yeah, sorry, go on.
Yes, absolutely. A great point that you bring up. And I guess every one of us underestimated Bitcoin in the short run. You know, we first all thought that this is a scam, that this is internet magic nerd money and that nobody's going to use it. But, well, the honey badger did not care. The money badger just went on. Bitcoin just kept going and going and going. And so, Saif, I think a big problem that Austrians have realizing that Bitcoin actually is a money is because that Karl Menger, Mises and Rothbard always used or always talked about a money in the three-dimensional physical world. So they always said that a tangible commodity, for example, gold or silver, needs to be first established on the free market as a barter exchange. It needs to be wanted for a secondary use, and then it can be used as a money, but only if it is a tangible commodity. And I would disagree here with the greats, which I hope I can do. Of course I can do. This is not a cult. Is that we do not need a tangible scarce good that is in the digital world. But the important aspect is the scarcity itself. So if we have a scarce good and that is useful as a medium of exchange, store of value, unit of account, then this is enough. Then a money will arise. And it just happens that in this internet of non-scarce goods, we have created something like Bitcoin, which introduces scarcity. So now we have a scarce but non-tangible commodity, a digital commodity, and that is Bitcoin. And because it is scarce, it is eligible for being a money, even after the regression theorem, just like Mises proposed it.
Yeah, I think also the disagreement is kind of overstated because it's not, Mises is offering an explanation of how money emerges out of barter and not through government diktat. So the point of the regression theorem is to just tell you, you know, you don't need the government to put the face of the king on the coin in order for gold to be money. It's an explanation of how gold can become money out of a situation of barter or how something could become money when we don't have money. It doesn't necessarily mean that nothing else can ever become money. It doesn't preclude that possibility. And I think that this disagreement is overstated because if you read what Mises says, you know, it's, and Menger too, you know, the criterion for what makes money is not the idea that it is tangible. It's the idea that it is freely traded on the market and that it emerges out of free exchange. That's really the key criterion. So obviously at their time, they didn't discuss whether something intangible could become money because there was no internet and there was no possibility of having something like that. But, you know, the tangibility was not an important issue for them. The paper money is tangible, doesn't make it good. the thing that really matters, the thing that determines whether something is good, sound money or not. And I quote Professor Salerno in my book, in his book Money Sound and Unsound. You know, at the beginning of the book, he lays it out that the difference between them is that sound money is exchanged on the market, and its value is determined by the people buying it and selling it or accepting it for payment. In other words, it's just purely a market good whose value is determined through free exchange. Unsound money is money whose value is enforced through government diktat or government authority. Government imposes the value on it. And I think that's really what I would tell Austrians that are skeptical. You know what? And this is why I had to just get over my skepticism after a while, which is that, you know, by 2013, and today this is even more true, there was a big market for Bitcoin. People are buying and selling Bitcoin every day, and it's liquid. And it's, you know, yes, sure, the price will crash and the price will drop and the price will rise, but there's no question that people are willingly paying the price of Bitcoin. People go and give each other goods and services in exchange for Bitcoin at rates that are determined by the market. And this is, for me, the most astonishing thing about Bitcoin. You know, the move from zero to having, you know, the move from being exchanged online for nothing to having value, to being exchanged for that pizza or being exchanged for any good at whatever at whatever exchange rate. Once you've had that move, it's that's it. You know, it's just become a market good. And so it emerged into becoming a market good. It had a valuation. People valued it. And then from then on, it started to gain a monetary role because people are using it as a store of value because it is scarce, because its supply is not easy to increase.
Nico, go ahead.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you bring up about the free market. And I don't believe that throughout human history have experienced a truly free market, because everything has been able to be confiscated and censored, like gold included. And this is the first time that we have a money that nobody can really take away from us by violence if we are doing the proper, taking the proper precautions. So that's, I think that's the major evolution here that people need to understand, that the censorship resistance is a very key property here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good. I'm also curious.
Go ahead.
One more question. I'm curious about Saifedean, your opinion on the fees, because this is also one thing that I still have to explain to people and struggle. People struggle to understand. Like in December, the fees were obviously very high, but I feel like there's also something good about that, because it kind of showed that while the fees were ridiculously high, people were still using the protocol, because this still is intended. And could this be a good sign for the future, when once we are going to run out of the mining reward eventually? So then I think.
Hello?
Just go ahead.
Any thoughts on that?
I think I lost you there towards the end, but I got most of your question when it comes to fees. I mean, see, this is a main point in my book, which is that, you know, I don't see Bitcoin as being a mass consumer payment solution. And I think this is the biggest problem that many people have with understanding Bitcoin. They have, it's a very simplistic consumer-facing, consumerist perspective of money and payments. It's like people think that PayPal is money. You know, you use MasterCard and PayPal and Visa, but these are the methods of payment. This is a system of payment. But the actual money that you're using is the dollar or the euro or the gold or whatever it is. That's an orthogonal issue from the method of payment. And so you can build payment systems on top of any kind of money, like gold and like Bitcoin. But if you think of Bitcoin as being a consumer payment system, then obviously it's completely failed. It's already failed. It's failed in 2013 because we realized then that, you know, Bitcoin, well, not just then, but I mean, it's been clear that Bitcoin won't be able to scale to a point where every single purchase happening everywhere in the world is recorded on it. And it's not even going to be able to scale to a point where maybe 100 million transactions a day could be recorded on it. It's just the limits of computing power mean that it's just highly impractical. And it's not just impractical, it's going to be completely inefficient compared to any other non-decentralized solution, any other centralized solution. Because in the way that Bitcoin works fundamentally is that everybody needs to have the balance of everybody else at every point in time so that they are able to make sure that that person, when they're making a payment to you, they haven't made the payment to somebody else. And so that's just always going to be a far more calculation-intensive process and computing power-intensive process than a centralized system where you rely on one party keeping the balance of people and then, or at least several parties, and then they can settle with one another. So the way that I see it is, you know, if you think about Bitcoin fees in terms of, if you compare them to Western Union or PayPal or MasterCard or Visa, then Bitcoin is unworkable. However, Bitcoin continues to grow even as these fees continue to rise. So maybe Bitcoin is something else. And that's the point of my book. Bitcoin is not the method of payment. Bitcoin is more like the monetary standard on which you would build methods of payments. So it's possible for us to have the entirety of all of the world payment systems that we have right now. We could have all of these. If hypothetically speaking, I'm not saying this will happen, I'm not saying this is how Bitcoin is going to grow, but just to illustrate the point, hypothetically speaking, if tomorrow we wake up and all of the world's central banks announce we are going to replace all of our current reserves of government money and gold with Bitcoin, then, you know, we can, obviously there'll be a massive revaluation of Bitcoin and other prices. But, you know, assume that gets settled in one day, and then the next day the dust settles. Well, then, you know, your Visa card, your MasterCard, your PayPal account, your checkbook, all of the methods of payments that you use today will be working with Bitcoin as a base layer. Okay, so then, you know, in terms of transaction fees and in terms of the possibilities for making payments with Bitcoin, you can have all of the things that we have today on top of Bitcoin. I'm not saying this is going to work out, obviously. I'm just using this to illustrate the point. But the way that I think it'll actually evolve is going to be very different from what we have right now. Bitcoin is going to allow us to reshape and restructure the way that methods of payments work. But the point is that Bitcoin, if you think of it as a settlement layer, if you think of it as a layer for the settlement of transactions, wherein the individual consumer transactions happen on second layer solutions, then you can see that Bitcoin's transactions are actually far, far, far cheaper than their actual alternatives, because the alternative is not your MasterCard payment. What Bitcoin is replacing is not Visa and MasterCard, as I was saying, it's the settlement payments between banks and central banks. And in particular, it's the settlement payments of money that is not anybody else's liability. That's the key point. So, yes, it is expensive for, say, a big bank in France to settle with a big bank in the US. You know, it takes time for them to clear the payment through their central banks and so on. But that's not even what Bitcoin is replacing, because that bank is settling with euros and dollars, which are liabilities of two central banks. What Bitcoin's actually replacing is the settlement in money that is nobody else's liability, which is the real meaning of the term cash, incidentally, which used to be the word that was used to refer to gold. So when people used to, if you read Hayek, you know, when Hayek refers to cash, he's referring to gold. This is what Mises and Hayek used to, this is what the term cash means. In other words, two kinds of payments, cash payments or credit payments. Credit payments are somebody else's liability. Cash payments are nobody's liability. And that only ever meant gold. But now we have another form of cash that is not anybody else's liability, and that's Bitcoin. Because if you hold Bitcoin, unlike the dollar and unlike the euro, it's nobody else's liability. So when you want to compare Bitcoin transaction fees, you don't compare them to Visa and MasterCard. You compare them to the cost of moving gold around. And so, you know, moving gold, moving $1 billion of gold from Europe to the US is extremely expensive. It's highly insecure. If the, you know, you put it on an airplane or on a boat and it's it can get hijacked, it can sink. There are all sorts of problems and issues with it. We saw last year or a few years ago when Germany repatriated some of its gold from the US, it took them, what was it, 3-4 years to complete the movement of the gold, and it cost millions of dollars to do it. Well, you know, you could move the same amount of value in Bitcoin. Well, not yet, but, you know, if Bitcoin continues to grow, I think you'll be able to move that trivially from one continent to the other in under 1 hour, okay? So complete settlement of hard cash in under 1 hour across continents, that's extremely powerful. And that's where I think Bitcoin's value is. So, you know, if you want to think about the Bitcoin transaction fees, I mean, this is going to make a lot of people go crazy when I say it, but, you know, Bitcoin transaction fees can continue to rise up until the price of that repatriation by the Deutsche Central Bank, by the German Central Bank from the U.S. Federal Reserve, and they'll still be a bargain. Okay. So because, you know, you could build then an entire financial system based on these. But the difference is that whereas the current system, because gold settlement is extremely expensive, we ended up with a system that's extremely centralized. So with gold, the movement of gold was very expensive. And that tends towards centralization. And the centralization is what allowed governments to take over gold and the gold standard and turn it into the fiat standard, because they, you know, the cost of settling payments across countries or even across within countries were really expensive at a low cost, were really expensive. And so there was always, you know, there was always benefits to economies of scale. We always went to a central bank in a city and then a central bank in the country. And then after World War One and World War Two, we moved towards a central bank for the whole world. Effectively today, we only have one real central bank, which is the US, because any other central bank has to settle more or less through the, has to settle through the US's central bank. So gold's expensive, gold being expensive and very difficult to move, tends us towards centralization, where we end up with very few international settlement payments taking place in gold around the world. Bitcoin allows us at current capacity to do 500,000 of these transactions around the world. I mean, this is proven. We've seen Bitcoin do 500,000 transactions per day. So if nothing changes in Bitcoin ever, you know, if we're never able to optimize Bitcoin transactions in any way whatsoever, we could still do 500,000 transactions per day. Which is, you know, these can be done, these can be intercontinental transactions that are settlement for final cash, and they can be done they can be done in under 1 hour. So the impact of that, and that's really the subtitle of my book and the key point I'm trying to communicate, the impact of that is that it would allow us an alternative to central banking that is far more decentralized. Instead of having one central bank per country and then effectively really one central bank for the whole world, we could have a monetary system built on thousands, maybe tens of thousands of central banks able to perform final settlement. And that would be far harder for governments to co-opt. And that's really where Bitcoin is interesting.
Great points you bring up, Saifedean. And I agree, Bitcoin is the electronic peer-to-peer cash system. It is in the white paper, it is in the title of the white paper, that this is cash, that is, this is not a money substitute, this is base money. But we're also joined from JW Weatherman. So JW, would you please introduce yourself quickly, and I'm sure you have a bunch of questions for Saifedean.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, actually, I disagree with everything Saifedean just said. No, that's starting to be my catchphrase when I join any conversation at this point. But unfortunately, that's not true, because Saifedean is awesome. If you guys are at the Mises Institute right now and you have not read Saifedean's book, then you're doing stuff out of order. Your priorities are a little skewed. I'm not sure how much the Mises week cost you, but I can guarantee you would have learned more had you just sat down and read his $30 book. So Can't recommend it enough. And he is, in my mind, he's the most important economist in the world right now, and probably the most honest as well. So I highly recommend you listen to what he says. I'm sure Saifedean said something something self-deprecating there, but it stands. You're the most important and the most honest economist in the world right now. And one of the reasons that I would say that is that and this is kind of my frustration with a lot of economists that are my heroes that are slowly dying and not becoming my heroes anymore, is the importance of what he just said about gold, that gold had certain, you know, I'm a security researcher, right? So I look at gold as a piece of technology. And from my perspective, if I was to threat model gold, I would say it has some security flaws that are going to lead to banking, right? And then I could threat model banking and say banking has security flaws that are going to lead to central banking. And I don't think that the Austrians in general are doing a good job recognizing that reality. Because if you recognize that reality that he just articulated really well, and that I can see clearly as a security researcher, you end up in a place where you don't want to push for political change, right? And education becomes important, but very, very much secondary. And the key, if you believe that those technologies had those flaws that would lead us to a place that is essentially modern day human slavery, where we have central banks completely destroying our ability to coordinate activities and be productive and solve problems and stay alive in this crazy universe. And they're doing that so that they can steal a percentage of our money on a regular basis and cause the boom and bust cycle. The solution to that problem, if it's a result of the properties of the technology that humanity had at its disposal, is obviously to create and to work for the development of new technologies, right? That's the obvious solution if you believe that the technology had flaws that brought this about. The problem with that, and this is one of the reasons that I respect Saifedean so much, is I don't know how you get paid doing that. If you just say we need to develop new technology and you're not a technologist, you're not shilling your new startup, you're just an honest, hardworking economist, you're not going to be able to get as many donations from people that are trying to support you as you put out your political message, right? The Libertarian Party, there's money involved in that, right? The ability to put out ideas that are very, very appealing to a minority, which, you know, there's a lot of gold bugs out there, right? There's a lot of people that are selling gold. So there's a whole business model there as well. There's not a whole lot of people that have a business model around getting you to buy Bitcoin or to study Bitcoin and understand that it is a better alternative for sound money than gold. And that's why I think we're at the stage of this technology being adopted, where you're only going to hear that message from people that actually care about their children, that actually believe what they're saying, and actually think that their children are going to die of some disease when they're 50 years old that would have otherwise been cured. And I think if you look at the people that are not interested in that, right, that are like at the Mises Institute right now, frankly, that have very little interest and very little passion for this particular topic of whether we have found a technology that can provide a sound money, I think you're just looking into the heart of darkness. I would rather be hanging out with Paul Krugman right now, frankly, than those guys, because I think that they are.
No.
All right.
You will not, JW. You would not stand Krugman.
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why Krugman pisses me off less. He's an honest liar in a sense, right? When it comes to religious sects and things like that, it is far easier for me to hang out with somebody that's an atheist than it is for me to hang out with somebody that's a semi-Calvinist. Nothing gets my goat more than somebody that's 2 degrees off and takes people that would otherwise educate their children in a positive and productive way and help people understand that we're on the cusp of a revolution. Those guys that are like 5 degrees off, they're the ones that are catching all of the most innocent and the most willing and the most productive, right? So no, frankly, I'm not exaggerating when I say those are the guys that piss me off the most. But Saifedean's a good guy, and I hate to put him on the spot like that. And I'm sure he wants to defend a lot of the people he respects right now. So I'll slow down a little bit. But that's my honest opinion.
No, you're just an internet anon trying to be controversial, JW. I think that's absurd. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, teaching people about the principles of sound money, even if you don't think that Bitcoin can work, even if you can't get Bitcoin, it's going to mean that others will go down that path and they will see it. And, you know, on the other hand, there is an element of age to it. It took me a lot of time to be able to really get why Bitcoin matters and why it can work. And it's not going to be easy. You know, I'm still in my 30s and it took me a lot of time. So I can imagine how much harder it would be for people in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And I think it's really unfair to try and disparage these people for not getting it. It's, you know, and the important thing about it is that Bitcoin doesn't need their approval at the end of the day. So it's not like they're hurting it in any way. It doesn't need their approval. It doesn't need my support or your support or anybody's support. It's Bitcoin's economic reality, as I like to all say, and it's going to impose itself whether people like it or not. So it's kind of a moot point to demand purity from others and demand what they think and say. So yeah, no, I still have a lot of respect for everybody at the Mises University. Don't listen to JW.
Yes, I agree here that Mises Institute and especially Mises University really have been a great part in educating people about economics. And that is the important part, because if you understand economics and you understand the true aspect of economics, then you will understand Bitcoin. I mean, if you read What Has Government Done to Our Money and substitute the word gold for Bitcoin, it still works out perfectly. So absolutely. We have here with me one student.
Just to clarify,
wait, let other students also talk. So we have here Attila. So what are your questions for Saifedean?
Yes. One thing about Bitcoin that Walter Block brought up is he said it's not a currency yet because there's not enough demand for it. So in your definition, what is a currency? What are the preconditions for anything to be considered a currency?
Talking about the general acceptability of money. So Walter's argument that it is not yet a money in the macroeconomic sense because not everyone is buying and using it for his goods and services.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about it, it's doing a better job at that than most government currencies. So, you know, the value of transactions taking place in Bitcoin is larger than most government currencies, and that's only in 10 years. I mean, it's pretty astonishing to think about it, that the value of Bitcoin is larger than the value of, say, I think the Egyptian pound. And, you know, Egypt has been around for 10,000 years, and their currency has been overtaken in 10 years by basically magic internet beans. So that's pretty impressive for less than 10 years. But I think... No, it's definitely a right point in that, you know, even amongst hardcore Bitcoiners, very few people use Bitcoin for their daily transactions. And there's still a long way to go. I'm not, you know, I need to always keep emphasizing this. I'm not trying to get you to buy Bitcoin. I'm not trying to advertise Bitcoin. And I'm not trying to tell people, you know, I'm not an evangelist for Bitcoin. I'm trying to explain the economic reality of why this thing just won't go away. Now, it might, you know, if you ask me, are we going to see Bitcoin at under 1,000 or over 100,000 or even at under 100 or over 100,000 first, which will come first? I don't know. We could well see Bitcoin drop below $100. I say this all the time. I tell it to people, don't think that it can't crash or demand for it won't drop. It's still a new and experimental technology. And we could witness a 99% even collapse in the market price of Bitcoin. And, you know, of course, the absence of a central bank and guns behind it to enforce this accessibility. You know, obviously, it's a great thing for us as Austrians. We love it because it's a free market money. But, you know, that just means that if there's a crash, if there's a problem, if governments clamp down on it, there could still be a serious crash in its value. And people need to take that into account. But in general, I think the point that I make in my book is that the reason it's likely to be able to play the role of money in the future in a very good way fundamentally comes down to the fact that its supply increases at a very low rate. And that, for me, is the key point. You know, Bitcoin's supply is fixed to 21 million. It's never going to go above 21 million. So this is it's only really a matter of time. Well, no, I wouldn't say it's only a matter of time. But if it is, if it does get a lot of time on it, if it does get another 10, 20, 30, 40 years of just continuing to exist and processing a new block of transactions every 10 minutes, like clockwork, every 10 minutes for another 40 years, you know, people are going to get this. People are going to start understanding. And the scarcity is going to enforce itself. All the other kinds of monies are going to be inferior as stores of value. And as people start to recognize that, you know, Bitcoin will be the most desirable as a store of value. And I think just like we saw with gold, you know, gold imposed itself as a monetary standard on the world, not because governments wanted it, not because governments imposed it, and not because, you know, gold miners marketed it well. Gold imposed itself because of economic reality. There was nobody in charge of that. It's just simply because gold supply increases at the lowest rate every year. That meant that it would be the most desirable good as a store of value. And that in turn gave it the highest saleability, which Menger discusses as the key criterion. So for me, the saleability is the issue. And the saleability comes from having a lot of holders. And holders come from the desirability of it being a store of value. And the desirability of a store of value ultimately boils down to a small increase in the rate of supply. You know, if you think about it, silver might have been a better money than gold because, you know, but for many reasons that silver bugs might tell you. But gold imposed itself fundamentally because at the end of the day, its supply increased at a much lower rate. And so more people wanted to hold gold. And if more people want to hold it, that just creates a deeper, more liquid market so that when you want to buy and sell, your purchase or your sale will have less of an impact on the price. And that's really the criterion of saleability. And so what I'm saying in my book, you know, I'm not making a prediction that it will happen. I'm saying this is why it hasn't died. This is why its value continues to go up. It might continue to do that. It might crash. But, you know, I think it's time that we start taking it a little bit more seriously as a monetary asset because it continues to refuse to die. And most importantly, after 2017, after all of the drama we saw with the scaling, we can now be fairly confident that its supply is not going to be altered. I mean, people couldn't change anything about Bitcoin in terms of its block size, which is almost a slightly inconsequential parameter. And, you know, people are going crazy trying to change it. And they started their own shitcoin in order to just try and make a Bitcoin that is with bigger blocks. And Bitcoin continues to operate unperturbed. And I think there's a huge lesson in there.
Yeah, great points that you bring up, Saif. And I absolutely agree. And you said that it is important that the supply of the money has to stay at a certain level. And already we have mined 17.5 million Bitcoins out of the 21 million. So the inflation rate from now on is going to decrease really, 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 really low. And we're going to stay with almost zero inflation rate for a vast majority of the next 100 years. So that is going to play out really interesting because, in my opinion, this was one of the biggest flaws in the Bitcoin system, was the high inflation rate in the early years. Because inflation always takes away the purchasing power from the savers and gives it to the persons or entities that are mining the new Bitcoins. Here, the miners, they're producing the new money. This is inherently not theft because, well, the Bitcoin users and the Bitcoin hodlers, they're in it voluntarily and they know the rules. So this is not theft. But on the other hand, and this is what Austrian economics teaches us, is that this creates malinvestments. It doesn't matter if it's voluntary or not. It creates wrong incentives. And in my opinion, the wrong incentives in the Bitcoin specifically were in the transaction fees, because transaction fees were subsidized, or they were paid not only by the person making the transaction, the person spending the UTXO, but also by the Coinbase output, by the UTXO that was given to the miner. And therefore, the total price of a Bitcoin transaction was heavily, heavily subsidized by this mining reward. And the user thought that cheap transactions were a feature of Bitcoin. Turns out, no, they weren't. They were actually always really expensive. They just were subsidized in the early years, heavily, heavily, with low transactions.
And because we have those incentives, people thought that they can use the block space much more. So a bunch of block space got malinvested. The resource, the block space, didn't get allocated to the most sufficient need. And that's why we saw something like Satoshi Dice, stuff that just fills up the blockchain. So Saif, would you just talk a bit about more how the early high inflation...
I have to say that is an excellent point, and I had never thought of it that way, but you make a very good point. We can think of the argument for cheap on-chain transactions as just being a product of the malinvestment caused by the inflation. However, you know, we have to think that, you know, the inflation in the early years for Bitcoin is a necessary thing, because, you know, if you started the coin with 21 million coins that are just there at the beginning, and, you know, Satoshi has them, well, of course, that system's not going to work, because, you know, we would have to, all of the world, you know, would have to just keep buying coins one by one from Satoshi until he practically owns half of the wealth of humanity. So obviously nobody would want to play that game with Satoshi. So you have to have a system where they were distributed. But of course, you know, the way that they did it was that it was not distributed randomly. It was distributed through proof of work. And that's an important reason why all of these attempts at creating a stable coin that you keep hearing about, which is now a big buzzword amongst VCs funding shitcoins. The idea that, you know, we can make a new coin that is just going to be immaculately conceived in a way that is distributed evenly across the world and everybody's able to use it, and the value is just widely distributed, I think is completely nonsensical. There's no easy way to bootstrap economic value, because economic value can't be, it can't just be decreed. It has to be earned, and it has to emerge. And so, yeah, Bitcoin is still quite inflationary. If you think about it, most likely we have about 4 million coins lost. Out of the 21 million, we have about 4 million lost permanently, because people at the beginning weren't very careful about how they were mining it. I would say, you know, I mean, the estimates vary, but if we assume that we have 4 million coins lost, then actually the number of coins that exist today is about 3 million coins, 13 million and not 17 million. And so the growth, the supply growth rate is more than just the 4% that it is officially. It's probably more like 7-8% or something like that. Maybe a little less, 6 or 7. So yeah, it's still relatively slightly inflationary in terms of the supply increasing, but, you know, it's still early days. The interesting thing will be in the late 2020s when the supply growth rate becomes practically inconsequential and insignificant towards the entire supply that actually exists. Then Bitcoin becomes like gold. So right now, you know, the mining is producing a significant amount of Bitcoins. The new coins that are being produced are significant compared to the market. And the way that gold became money is that the new supply was always became more and more insignificant compared to the existing stockpile. In other words, the value, if you look at the gold market, you know, even as much money as people are spending into mining and making new coins everywhere, the value of the new gold coins that are being, or new amounts of gold that are being mined from the ground, is practically inconsequential. It's a rounding error compared to the value of the gold that is being sold and bought from the existing stockpile. Not yet the case with Bitcoin, but I think if Bitcoin survives and continues to operate as it has and reaches a point where the new output from mining, I'm not talking about the transaction fees, but the new output from mining becomes so low that it is essentially inconsequential compared to the total volume of coins, that's when, you know, Bitcoin's monetary metal will be tested. Will it really be able to continue to operate? Will it become like gold? And I think that'll be really interesting. So I would say we've still got another maybe 10 years to see that happen in earnest, but we'll see.
Great points. And I agree, the inflation was necessary in order to spread the word of Bitcoin and in order to spread the Bitcoin. And proof of work is by far the best way that we ever had in inflated money. But the malinvestments are still there. So, Nico, go ahead.
Yeah, I really like the point you brought up, Saifedean, about the hodlers actually increasing liquidity through holding and creating demand. I think that makes a lot of sense. And because I hear a lot people say that if people just hold and they don't spend, it's kind of like Keynesian way of thinking that spending is somehow inherently good. This is something I have to struggle with every day with my work with people, because people simply don't understand. People don't want to understand, and it's not taught to people. I find it a huge problem. I think these kind of things, this is like Austrian economics makes sense. It's logics. It should be taught in the primary schools already. However, you brought up mining. I would like to ask you a question about that as well. Mining and specifically energy consumption, which is another thing that I have to combat constantly, because that's the goal. Like, after all these bogus reasons of like drug money and blah blah blah, I mean, good money, you can use it for drugs and everything, and you can buy illegal things. That's what good money is. And once these kind of like accusations and points don't fly anymore, now it's the energy consumption is killing the planet, which I think is ridiculous compared to how much fiat money, for example. We don't even know how much it actually consumes energy. And I heard this interesting theory, actually. I don't remember who brought it forth, but his view, however, is that Bitcoin is not secure until it consumes 51% of all potential energy in the world. Have you heard of that, and have you thought of it that way? Do you think it makes sense to you?
Yes, I have thought of that, and I think there is an element of truth in that. Because I think essentially what is going to end up happening is that, I mean, if we want to take Bitcoin seriously, if Bitcoin continues to grow, then you reach a point where the marginal return on a unit of electricity will have to be equal if you spend it on making new Bitcoin or if you spend it on producing actual economic goods. And so therefore, if Bitcoin is the only money out there, Bitcoin contains all the value that is, you know, if the Bitcoin produced today, the new Bitcoins produced today, are the only things that are being used to trade the wealth, the extra wealth that is being produced today, then roughly the value of it is going to be the same. So the value of the new Bitcoin produced today is going to be equal to the value of the economic production produced today at the margin. And so then the use of electricity, if Bitcoin is consuming less electricity than half of what the world is consuming, then it's more profitable to move electricity from economic activity towards Bitcoin. That's one way of thinking of it. I'm not sure I entirely agree with it, because, of course, things are going to get more complicated, because mining doesn't just produce new coins, it also produces transaction fees. So that's not entirely accurate. And of course, the other thing about it, and I have thought about this, as I said, and I used to sort of think of it, and I think it's a good way to shock and jar people into understanding the importance of Bitcoin by telling them, when people tell me, yeah, Bitcoin is consuming as much electricity as Poland, then I think, oh my God, what the hell are they doing in Poland? We should shut down Poland. We could double the electricity and safety of Bitcoin. Jokingly, obviously, but I think that the other reason that I don't really believe this much anymore is that, so the first one is that the mining is not just the new coins, it's the transaction fees, so this dynamic doesn't really apply. Secondly, it's that there was another point that I wanted to make. The other thing is that if you look at the energy that's going to be used towards Bitcoin, I mean, if you look at mining right now, you know, there are people who are mining on the grid, but pretty much anywhere you see mining on the grid, it's essentially subsidized by the grid or the people operating the grid. So, you know, there are places in the world where they have a very large a very large power generation infrastructure that allows them to have very cheap water. If that, by grid, specifically I'm talking about fossil fuel mining or hydrocarbon mining. So if you have an electric generator in a city that is huge and it's producing a lot of electricity and that city happens to have cheap electricity, people in that city will start mining Bitcoin. But what that's going to do is that it's going to raise the price of electricity in that city until it matches everywhere else. In other words, Bitcoin is going to give us a completely liquid market in energy, because energy can now be produced anywhere in the world and used to mine Bitcoin. So I don't really see much of a future for Bitcoin mining on hydrocarbons, because the cost of energy on hydrocarbon is highly expensive, and Bitcoin is going to effectively be outbid by, you know, people wanting to stay warm and light up their homes, because that's kind of valuable. But where Bitcoin's real advantage in mining lies is that, you know, it doesn't need to be in places where it's close to the to civilization, to society, where there is demand for electricity. In other words, you know, I think the most profitable businesses, the most profitable mining models right now are not the ones that are, you know, leeching on a power plant that has excess capacity. This is not really very sustainable over time. That city is going to grow, or they're going to start, you know, they're going to raise the rates on the miners, because they're not just going to keep letting those miners essentially make a lot of money and get rich off of the fact that the rest of the city is getting, you know, off of the fact that the city with taxpayer money had built this grid. So I see that the way that I see it is that all of the hydroelectric potential power sources around the world that are far away from cities, you know, you have enormous amounts of energy there. But the problem with it is that it can't be used to light up the city and move to the city, because the transportation of the energy is pretty expensive. You know, energy, so you have a river, let's say, Francis Pouillot, who's in Montreal, he was explaining this, that the amount of waste that happens in the hydroelectric power in Quebec near Montreal is enormous. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's far larger than the Bitcoin network. I wouldn't say waste necessarily, but it's just because there's no scale for Montreal even absorbing all of that much power, in terms of when the snow melts and then all of that water is flowing into the rivers. That water can't be utilized for electricity, because we don't have batteries that big that can store it for Montreal to use it at the other rest of the year. And, you know, there are no easy ways of storing energy that don't involve significant costs. But Bitcoin is a great way of storing energy, because you put a bunch of miners there, the opportunity cost of that energy is almost zero. So you just need to build the infrastructure for the miners to absorb that energy. And they will, you know, they'll be able to turn that energy into Bitcoin, and then throughout the rest of the year, you can convert that Bitcoin into energy through other sources. And more generally, I think the really optimistic thing about it is that the way I see it is that, think about all of the places that are isolated, which have enormous sources of energy, whether it's geothermal or hydroelectric or oil fields that are very far, that have excess methane production. In many of the oil fields, you know, they produce methane that is so plentiful, but the problem with it is that it's not cheap to transport. And so in many cases, they burn the methane. They take out the oil, they burn the methane, because the methane is not economical. So I know somebody in northern Alberta in Canada whose mining business runs like that. His name is Steve Barbour. You can check him on Twitter. He runs a business like that. He builds units that are just completely autonomous units that you just put it in a like a shipping container, and you just put it next to the place where the methane is coming out, and then there's an engine in it. The engine takes in the methane, it burns it, and it operates the miners. And so this is also energy that was going nowhere. So that gets burned. That's really where people who are mining profitably, that's what they're doing. And that's why, you know, other people who are trying to run on hydrocarbon just simply can't compete and won't be able to compete, I think, in the long run. I mean, I'm not sure, actually. They might still be able to compete if Bitcoin mining continues to becomes more and more profitable. But with the difficulty adjustment, the way that I see it is that the people who use energy that has a low opportunity cost, energy that is wasted, energy that is far from the cities, will have an enormous advantage. And the effect of this is that these places will develop infrastructure to support Bitcoin mining, and they're going to make profits from it that are going to then lead, I think, to more industrialization and civilization going there. So, you know, you can imagine that in places where you have flooding and very big rivers, you know, you start off with small Bitcoin miners, and then with the profits, you start building bigger infrastructure, you start building bigger hydroelectric dams. Over 5-10 years of mining, you've utilized the profits, and you're able to tame the extra energy that goes on there. You're able to tame the river, tame these massive sources of energy that usually are destructive. You know, many areas of the world are beautiful to look at, but there are parts of the year when the rivers flood and then nobody can live there. Well, you know, if we have hydroelectric dams financed by Bitcoin mining over 5-10 years, then that area suddenly becomes inhabitable because the dam is making it, the dam is making it safe from flooding. So I think this is really the real potential of it. It's going to allow for far more energy production all over the world in places that we don't, we can't usually make energy at because they're usually too expensive and too, too isolated to build that infrastructure because there's just no demand for it. So all of this, think about all of the isolated rivers in the world, in the north of Canada or in the Amazon or in Africa. These places, they don't get proper infrastructure because building that infrastructure would be too expensive. But if you have Bitcoin mining to utilize that extra energy, you'll be able to then build infrastructure and then you'll have growing cities. And I think, you know, one vision of Bitcoin's energy consumption is that the way I like to think of it is that we're going to tame every flooding river in the world with Bitcoin miners. We're going to use Bitcoin miners on each one of these, and so that it will finance the building of dams and securing that energy. And we're going to just utilize more and more of that energy. And of course, you know, the deeper answer to the question of Bitcoin's energy waste is simply that energy is a good thing. The notion that we need to reduce our consumption of energy is a ridiculous, and even criminal idea propagated by some environmentalists. You know, the only effective way of reducing your energy consumption is death. That's it. You know, if you think that you consume too much energy, kill yourself. Problem solved. That's when you're going to stop consuming energy. But if you look at, the only way that we are able to survive the winter in most of the world is through energy consumption. And people who have the least energy consumption in the world are living the most dangerous, the most hard lives in the world. And you don't want to live with lower energy. As life gets better, we consume more energy. As we consume more energy, life gets better. More accurately, and that's just how life is. We need more energy consumption to live better, and that's going to always be the case. And it's not like, you know, we're tapping into a fixed reserve of energy. The amount of energy available on this planet is infinite for all practical intents and purposes. The wind energy, the thermal energy, the hydroelectric energy, it's enormous. There are enormous sources of energy, and the only issue is just using our mind and our abilities to be able to tame that energy and channel it from the places where it is plentiful to the places where it is needed. And Bitcoin is going to be an absolutely astonishing, and people will be shocked at this over time, it'll be an absolutely astonishing technological tool that we use to tame energy like that. It's going to allow us to take energy from places where it is plentiful, convert them into Bitcoin, and then, you know, use that profit in order to finance the consumption of energy in many other places. So, yeah, I look forward to Bitcoin consuming much, much more energy than it already does.
Yeah, this was one of your another fantastic points that just blows your mind. Of course, Bitcoin increases the demand for electricity, for energy. Therefore, more producers will go out and produce this. Basic Austrian economic teachings, right? Supply follows demand. Fabulous point. Thank you. JW, you have a question.
Yeah, actually, I did want to clarify my gauntlet that I threw down earlier. I definitely was not trying to say that guys like Mises or Rothbard were not super valuable. And I do think that there are guys, you know, like Hoppe and Tim May, that they have fought the good fight for a lot of years, and they absolutely deserve to enjoy some rest. So my insults are reserved specifically for the economists that are alive today and are working today and are producing content and are saying stuff like it's not money because it hasn't been adopted for use as money yet. To me, that's just, they're too smart to be that dumb. I think they're being dishonest. And I'm not going to list a bunch of people. I don't even know who they are really yet because I haven't had that many conversations with these folks. But those are the folks that my disdain is reserved for. And I do think Safe kind of reminds me a little bit of Luther in the sense that I think he's just a good academic, right? He's just trying to be a nice guy and write good material and post it to the academic forum like any good academic would do. But I also think that he's posted the 95 thesis and he doesn't realize it yet. And there are a bunch of anon internet trolls like me that are racking our brains trying to figure out how we can fan that flame and cause it to be a big church split, let's call it. Yeah, I think that's kind of where we're at right now. I was trying to think of a question that I can ask you that you haven't been asked a million times, and that's always hard for somebody that's written a book on a specific topic. So let me ask you this, and it's something that I'm trying to get you to just kind of use your knowledge of history, human nature, and general wisdom, right? So it's not directly an economics question, but do you think the transition, if we are facing a transition to a sound money, whether it's Bitcoin or something else, do you think that would be orderly and smooth, or do you think it would be chaotic and dangerous? And how do you think like the average person should prepare for something like that?
You know, there was always that image of people thinking of it as being just hyperinflation, that, you know, it's just going to be Venezuela on a worldwide scale. And, you know, a lot of people had that idea of how hyper-Bitcoinization would look. But the more that I think about it, I lean more towards the peaceful, orderly, and just extremely beneficial transition, where it just happens gradually in that, you know, as any individual moves towards Bitcoin, their lives improve. And because, you know, suddenly they have a better store of value and they're able to hold value better into the future. And so they lose less to inflation. They are able to think of the long term. They start saving more. Their time preference drops. They start becoming more future oriented and their life becomes better. Not necessarily very quickly, but, you know, within 5-10 years, pretty much, you'll witness an improvement in your standard of living because of Bitcoin. And so one way of thinking of it is that this will just happen gradually, one by one, all over the world. And it's just, we're moving to a much more efficient, much better world because we're going to have an amazing technology that underpins the economic system of the world that is unlike anything that we've ever seen. And so I would expect that the Bitcoin future is going to be far more prosperous than the present. I think we're going to have enormous technological advancements once people are able to save again and think of the long run. And, you know, we're going to be more like the 19th century, but with 21st century technology. And that's just an absolutely astonishing thing to think about, because it's not even something we can imagine. In the same way that people in the 17th and 18th century couldn't have imagined the airplane and the car and the all of these wonderful technologies of the 19th century, you know, I think we still have no idea what the 21st century under Bitcoin would bring if it does come to pass. And so I think one way of thinking of it is that, I don't know, I'm more inclined to think that, you know, once you get what's going on with Bitcoin, you're going to be too busy just moving on and trying to get as much Bitcoin as you can, as fast as you can, rather than trying to fight the people who have it or trying to stop it. I think this is really the power of this idea and the power of economic reality. It's just going to impose itself on people in a way that, you know, it's irresistible, you know. And so the way that I see it is that it might take a lot of time, and it might be very gradual, and there might be setbacks along the way. But I doubt we'll have that doomsday hyperinflationary scenario where the whole world is Zimbabwe or Venezuela. I think it's just going to be, you know, one person at a time we move towards this beautiful future. And I certainly hope so.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. Again, Austrian economics, right? We don't talk about the culture, the community, the greater good. No, we talk about the individual, the free human being that has his own free will and does his own choices. And you as the user have a chance to right now use Bitcoin. And many, many people do, including me. I've been using Bitcoin for 1.5 years now as my only money. I dropped out of the fiat system because it sucks. I'm using Bitcoin for each and every transaction. And this is going to happen on a user level, on an individual level, more and more and more. So I'm enjoying the conversation so far. It's been fantastic. I'm writing a bachelor thesis on anarchy in money and why we neither need nor want government intervention in money and especially Bitcoin. And one big part of that is, of course, anarchy, anarchon, without rulers. Nobody is enforcing a government monopoly, so we have competition in money. And we have several different alternatives that the individual user can choose. Of course, between Bitcoin, gold, and the dollar, yes. But also in the Bitcoin cryptocurrency ecosystem, we have thousands and thousands of competitive currencies that are all vying for the biggest market share.
No, we don't. We only have Bitcoin. That's it.
Go ahead. So why is there a natural tendency towards one money, as Menger explains it, and how is that going to work out?
Yeah, there's a tendency for one money that, you know, even in Menger's time, it wasn't as pronounced, because back then there was still a role to be played by silver because it was a smaller scale medium for payments. But then, you know, once most payments became in instruments that were backed by gold, there was no longer any reason for anybody to hold silver. And so silver lost its monetary role around the same time that Menger wrote his Principles book in 1870. And, you know, in my book, basically, I show the chart of the silver-gold ratio. It the price of silver began to collapse in 1870 after the Franco-Prussian War, because Germany went on the gold standard. After that, they took they took money from France after the war, and they took it in gold, switched to the gold standard. And once Germany had switched from silver to gold, you know, there were already the majority of the most advanced economies were already on gold. And so when Germany switched, that was like that tipped the balance in favor of gold. And then everybody started dropping silver and moving towards gold. And the countries that stayed on silver late suffered massively from it, because you see how the price went from about 13, 14 ounces of silver per 1 ounce of gold all the way to 40, 50, 60. I think it's in the 60s now or something like that. So if your country was on a silver standard in on 1890 or 1900, like China and India, it was a massive, massive problem. Essentially, money is a winner-take-all market, except in the situations, you know, if you think about it earlier, it wasn't so much because different kinds of saleability were found in different kinds of money. So silver was better at smaller scales, gold was better at bigger scales. But, you know, as we move towards new technology and communication, these things become less important. With industrialization, we can make things in any kind of scale. So it doesn't really matter. So we end up with one form of money. So that's really why I think there would be one. But this, I think, is really more applicable towards understanding why Bitcoin would compete with other forms of money and likely win. But with the altcoins, I even don't think that they compete with Bitcoin in any meaningful sense. I don't think they would even be like silver, because for the very simple reason that Bitcoin is the only one that has a credible monetary policy. Bitcoin is the only one that can really claim to say, well, this is how much Bitcoins we're going to have next year, and that's it. And you can trust it. You know, this is how many Bitcoins we have today. You know, 100 years from now, we're going to have, this is how much Bitcoin we're going to have, and that's it. How do we know that? Well, good luck trying to change it. We've seen in the last 8, 9, 10 years how hard and how almost impossible it is to change Bitcoin. And this is something that, you know, you just can't explain to people. I try and explain it in my book, but it's not something that people are going to understand by reading my book. It's something that they're going to understand after reading my book and waiting 5 years and seeing just how impossible it is to change Bitcoin. It's just something you have to see Roger Ver freaking out and losing his mind in order to really understand how it goes. You know, when Roger Ver and Gavin Anderson and all of these startups that basically controlled about 90% of all of the customers who were using Bitcoin and all of the miners who controlled about 90% of the hash rate, when all of them get together and try and change the block size of Bitcoin and then they all fail miserably, you know, that's when you start to really get to the point of why it can't change. So this is why none of the other coins are even comparable. This is why they don't even matter. And this is why, frankly, it pisses me off when we even talk about any of them, because it is trivial for any of them to change their money supply tomorrow. You know, we've seen with the biggest of these so-called supposed competitors, Ethereum, we saw how when things didn't go well for the programmer, for the people who run it, the foundation behind it, it took them a couple of years. They hard forked it, changed the rules, changed everything, and then they got their money back. So, you know, if you can do that with Ethereum, you can do it with any of the other altcoins. And so if you can do it with reversing transactions, you can do it with changing the money supply. You can do it with changing the monetary policy. So if we want a coin that has a monetary policy that is backed by somebody that is just dependent on the word of someone and on the honesty of someone controlling it, you know, that's maybe possible that a coin like that would compete with Bitcoin, but it will definitely not be a coin that copies Bitcoin's structure. That's really a key point. Like maybe we're going to get a centralized competitor to Bitcoin that is better than Bitcoin. And, you know, I don't completely discount the possibility. However, I do discount the possibility that that coin will be one of the altcoins that we have today, which are all using Bitcoin's extremely sophisticated and expensive and inefficient structure, whose only advantage is to get rid of a third party, and using it for no reason other than to pretend to be Bitcoin in order to scam people into buying them and to make money from them. But really, they are controlled by a central party. So, you know, if you're going to be controlled by a party like the foundations that control all of these coins, or like the programmers that control all of these coins, you don't need the blockchain. You don't need any of this stuff. Go and make an efficient centralized coin that is like, you know, that would have its payment system centralized like PayPal, and it can be processing much cheaper transaction and has a centralized authority in charge of it. And then, you know, you'll have a much better chance of competing with Bitcoin, because you're playing to your strength. You're never going to be able to compete with Bitcoin by being trustless and immutable. So just own it. Don't be trustless. Don't be immutable. And say, you know, we're a market good. We're a market competitor. Here we are. This is our inflation schedule. We're going to stick to it, and we're going to establish credibility over 10, 20 years of trying to stick to it. And, you know, we're going to try and compete with Bitcoin. Maybe we'll get something like that, but it definitely won't be any of the altcoins that we have today. And of course, you know, I'm highly skeptical of us getting something like that, because if it does succeed, that thing will be co-opted by governments. And in fact, you know, we already have things like that. They are called government money. We've got hundreds of them. And, you know, we see the problem with centralized coins. The problem with centralized coins is that they end up always, as Guido Hulsman explains, you know, the temptation to mess with the money supply, the temptation to just benefit from the inflation of the extra money supply has just proven to be too strong all throughout human history. So I wouldn't hold my hopes up on any coin like that is centralized competing with Bitcoin, simply because, you know, if it does succeed, I think it will be co-opted, and it will be made inflationary to benefit the people who own it. And even if it doesn't, it will never be able to establish the sort of credibility that Bitcoin has. With Bitcoin, that's it. You know the scarcity is there. You know there's nothing anybody can do about it. So no amount of government rules and laws and regulations and constitutions and, you know, parliamentary decisions will ever have the kind of immutability that Bitcoin has. So, yeah.
Absolutely. As soon as there's a centralized party that is controlling the currency, the government can come in and kick down the doors and take away the money, or, you know, make them do whatever they want to do. So absolutely, all currencies should be decentralized. And that's hard. And that's why Bitcoin is so important. So, Nico, go ahead. Next question.
Thanks. Yeah, Saif, I really loved what you said, that Bitcoin has no competition. That's what I tell people and tick people off normally by saying so. But I think you made an awesome case on that. And at the moment, that truly isn't a chain that we could trust or that offers the same utility. That might change. And I'm positive there will be a Fed coin. There will be a Amazon coin, Facebook, or whatever is the flavor of the day. And I don't think that matters to Bitcoin at all. I think it might actually benefit Bitcoin because people like options. And then they are going to store their wealth in somewhere, and there's only one option for now. Well, maybe gold. And also, that's another thing that I wanted your opinion on. You talked about scarcity and in gold and in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, in my opinion, has much better scarcity because gold is not truly scarce. And you know, like if the demand of gold should suddenly go up and the price goes up, then of course there's an incentive to mine more. And there's like things like asteroid mining that I learned recently about. That could surface at some point if the gold reaches a certain price level. So my question is that do you think that gold is going to suffer a crash because of Bitcoin or a similar digital scarce asset?
I don't know. It's a complicated question. I discussed this in my book. I would say, you know, the only real competition for Bitcoin is gold in the long run. And I am, you know, contrary to, even though I'm perceived as the Bitcoin guy, I still wouldn't write off gold. We have had many, many, many contenders come along across the years and think that they've written off gold. And, you know, that little yellow shiny metal has just continued to do its own thing since forever. It's pretty astonishing if you think about it. You know, historical records for a very long time show us that the price of, say, a cow is at around 1 ounce of gold, always has been all throughout human history. And that's, you know, that's something, you know, for all of Satoshi's genius, you know, maybe we won't be able to get to get over gold. One, you know, in my book, when I discuss the scenarios for Bitcoin failure, what I find to be the most likely scenario, I'm not saying it is likely, but I'm saying it's more likely than all of the other sort of nonsense that you hear about on TV in terms of, you know, well, government will just shut down the internet or government will just... I don't think these things can really kill Bitcoin, but I think what would really kill Bitcoin or has the best chance of killing Bitcoin, or at least harming it most, would be a return to the gold standard. If all the governments of the world got together and said, okay, Bitcoin's going to eat our lunch, and it's going to be really bad. So let's just turn back time to the 1890s and create a monetary system built around gold and offer people a complete free market in money where banks can do whatever they want and we don't supervise banking, we don't do anything. You know, if you had that, I think a very large number of people who buy Bitcoin right now, who have demand for Bitcoin, would switch from Bitcoin to gold because, first of all, it has 6,000-year first-mover advantage, and it is far more widely distributed all over the world. Of course, you know, the problems JW mentioned in terms of the centralization, yes, they're definitely true, but, you know, it's still a far more realistic competition than any of the altcoins or government money.